You ever wonder why do you start with Romans and end with Philemon? What order are they in? Subject matter would be a good guess, because Romans is big, important stuff. Philemon is about one person. So you might could say, you know, another, yes. It fits the song, and clearly they had the... See, we have four doors at the back of the auditorium, so we can get people like you out as quickly as possible. It fits the song. That's good. How long is the book of Romans? How many chapters? 16. How many chapters is the book of 1 Corinthians? 16. How many chapters is the book of 2 Corinthians? 13. Are we seeing a trend? They seem to have put the long ones in the front. How long is Philemon? One. So it's not a perfect, you know, word count order, but it seems like they put the long ones in the front and the short ones in the back. That's the best we can do on why they arranged it in that order. If you look, you know, after that you go to Galatians, 6 chapters, Ephesians, 6 chapters. Philippians and Colossians are both 4 chapters, so you kind of get smaller. Now, 1 Thessalonians is 5 chapters, so I messed you up, but it's still fairly brief. 2 Thessalonians is 3 chapters. 1 Thessalonians is written only a few months after Paul left Thessalonica. He had just been there and was deeply concerned about them, and so immediately turns around and writes them a letter back. 1 Thessalonians deals with concerns about what happens next. So if you're being persecuted, or if you're just converted and you know that this is going to be hard, you wonder what happens next. And so 1 Thessalonians deals a lot with hope, about the promise of the resurrection and the certainty of Christ's return, and you need to be ready for that. 2 Thessalonians comes a few months after that, and it seems that they had gotten carried away, that they were so now convinced that Christ was coming back, some of them had stopped working, and were kind of just waiting for the heavens to open up and for Christ to show up. And Paul has to say, well, no, hang on. Actually, it's not quite like that either. And so it's a set of letters that were correcting this concern in the city of Thessalonica. That seems to be going on. So 51 AD are likely dates based on where Paul is in his Macedonian tour. 1 and 2 Corinthians, date a little later, 55 and 56 AD. Again, those are ballpark numbers, deeply debated, especially 2 Corinthians. There's a lot of debate. We had to read so many articles on 2 Corinthians in school. There are guys who think 2 Corinthians was originally 5 letters, and then it got put together, and then it was edited. And again, some people just like to be published, and so these ideas come up. But anyway, 1 Corinthians deals with the worldly influences that thrived in the church at Corinth. It was a very worldly, very Hellenized city, and the church struggled there. This Sunday, and through the middle of February, we're going to start a sermon series out of 1 Corinthians, the first 3 or 4 chapters, because I think it's a great model for the mess the church is in today. The church in a very rotten culture. Ah, that sounds kind of familiar to me. So Corinth, I think, is a good blueprint for us in many ways. 2 Corinthians deals with the ramifications of the first one. 1 Corinthians had given them some instructions. Some of those instructions seem to have gone well, some of them not. And so 2 Corinthians comes back to that and addresses it. This is a little speculative. I'm not a 2 Corinthians expert. But there seems to be a little more tension between Paul and his audience in 2 Corinthians. And it's entirely possible that he made some enemies with 1 Corinthians, and that 2 Corinthians were having to come back around now and not just straighten things out by making commands, but now he has to sell himself a little more. 2 Corinthians spends a lot more time with Paul discussing Paul. Why should you even bother to listen to Paul? What do we know about this Paul? So 2 Corinthians is a response to what came out of 1 Corinthians. And if you read the book of 1 Corinthians, you can understand where there might have been some angry people because he told them basically everything they were doing was wrong. Well, it's not quite that bad, but it's close. Galatians, another one that's debated a little bit. 56 is the date you'll get in most books. It deals with the role of the gospel in a world that had previously only known the Hebrew Scriptures. So now we have the Gentiles being brought in, and what do we do about that? And Galatians is asserting that all people who are baptized are of the same value in Christ and of the same salvation and promise. One guy I really like, N.T. Wright, says actually it's even earlier than that. He thinks it happened in about 48 A.D. and is the first book written in the New Testament. He thinks it's the letter Paul wrote while he was on his way to the discussion about the Gentiles in Acts 15. Remember, they all get together in Jerusalem in Acts 15, and they have a discussion about what to do about the Gentiles. Peter speaks, James speaks, Paul speaks, and Barnabas speaks. And so his contention is that this is the book where Paul, on his way there, is kind of setting forth his case. This is the doctrinal case in favor of the Gentiles in the church. I think it's interesting. Romans then would be a little later, as the church continues to spread into this empire, 57 AD. It's a masterpiece. It is the beginning of bigger ideas. How to say this? Jesus doesn't spend a lot of time himself talking about what his death accomplished, because he wasn't dead yet. The early Christian writers, the earliest epistles, deal a lot with behavior and why you should follow Christ. Romans is one of the first books that attempts, and obviously by the Spirit does a wonderful job, to explain what that means, that Christ has died according to the Scriptures and has been resurrected according to the Scriptures. How does that work? Why did God do it? What happens to you? And those kind of big questions that they now had time for, as things were settling down a little bit, the second generation starts asking, okay, why did Jesus die? That's a question you would eventually want to have an answer to. Romans is going to come around to questions like that and say, well, there's a very good reason. Okay. Moving ahead, the prison epistles were all written during one of Paul's various imprisonments, and they include Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and the very short epistle of Philemon. The date of the writing of these epistles, while uncertain, falls within about a five-year window. If you think he wrote it while he was in prison at Caesarea, that happened between 57 and 59 A.D. If you think it was when he was in prison at Rome, which is the traditional answer, then it's 60 to 62 A.D. Again, by a commentary written in the last 50 years, they're going to tell you Paul didn't write any of those books, and we don't know when they were written. But that's because, well, it's because they and I haven't talked yet. Ephesians and Colossians are books that seem to be deeply connected in theme and topic. Both the books of Colossians and Ephesians are delivered by the same man. Paul calls him by name, Tychicus, which is a fun name to say. Tychicus is delivering these letters. Ephesians is longer and is probably the more general version and would have been circulated among the churches. Why do we say it's the one that would have been circulated? Well, one, it's longer. But two, it doesn't have nearly as many personal references. In Colossians, nearly the whole last chapter is just personal references. Say hello to this person, say hello to that person, say hello to this person. Ephesians has almost none of that, even though it's a longer epistle. So we think Colossians was probably written as a version of this letter to one group, the church at Colossae, whereas the one written to Ephesus kind of circulated a bit, around and around it went. My tablet goes blank. I'll actually have to remember all this, and that'll be trouble. Oh, there it comes back. Okay. Oh, everything went blank. Here, I thought it was just my tablet. There it is. Yay. Okay. Philippians uses Paul's circumstances in a Roman prison as a launching point for a letter about spiritual maturity. So there was some bickering in the otherwise good congregation of Philippi, and he wants to put a stop on that. And so he reminds them, I'm in prison. Okay. Do your problems seem smaller when the person who's writing you this letter is in prison? Yeah. So all the things they were fighting about, whatever it might have been, Euodia and Syntyche in chapter 4 have this argument that's mentioned. two influential women in the congregation are having some kind of dispute, and Paul spends three or four chapters getting to that point and then saying, you know, maybe you could work that out since I'm in prison. maybe you could work that out. I think you could. It's a very mild rebuke compared to 1 Corinthians, which is scathing. So we think Philippi was a great congregation. But even great congregations can grind to a halt when you have some kind of personality dispute. In fact, that's usually how it happens. There are probably more examples of churches that have a problem like Philippi than like Corinth, where Corinth, everything is coming unhinged. Philippi, everything seems to be going pretty well, except there's a personality problem that's putting a wedge in an otherwise healthy congregation. Philemon is a personal letter from Paul to the owner of a runaway slave who is now a Christian, and it's a ticking time bomb in Christian history. Paul never directly says slavery is evil. Instead, he says, I'm sending your slave back, and I know because you're a good person, you'll treat him like a brother in Christ. And he just kind of drops it. And that epistle, very personal, you know, dealing with Philemon, over time, that idea is really hard to ignore. Can you own a slave, a human being, as a piece of property and love him as a brother at the same time? And when you get to the great reformations in society like Wilberforce and the overthrow of the English and European slavery, they're reading out of their New Testaments. And it's stuff like Philemon that says, I just don't think this can possibly be the way Christians treat each other. So without a direct condemnation of what had been institutionalized in Roman culture, he just lays down the framework that would eat away at it for centuries until it now, you know, we think of it as an unthinkable thing. Can't even imagine doing that. Well, what changed our view from the first century, where it was fairly normal, and even not very long ago in American history, where it was fairly normal? Again, Christianity just ate away at that idea. The rest of the Pauline epistles are sometimes called the pastorals. 1st, 2nd Timothy, and Titus are written to young ministers who are in the process of getting churches off the ground and are on their own for the first time. These are guys who have been traveling around with Paul, but now they're on their own and they have jobs to do. And these are the closest thing the New Testament has to church manuals. I mean, where it's instructions for the daily life of the church, not morality and not doctrine. It's quite literally who says the prayers kind of stuff. Who is the elder? Who is a deacon? What do we do with widows? I mean, it's very, I don't want to say technical because it's not complicated, but it's very nuts and bolts, how does the church operate kind of questions. The kind of thing you would write to a young preacher who is trying to make it work, like Timothy and Titus. So 1 Timothy and Titus 55 and 57 contain pretty technical instructions for young preachers, helping to maintain order in local congregations. What's the first job Timothy and Titus are given? Yeah, appoint elders. When I became a preacher, I was told by the old preachers, and I don't know if you ever heard this advice, I was told, three things you can do to get yourself fired. Appoint elders, appoint deacons, and build a building. I've gone for the hat trick here at Glenpool, so I'm doing what I can, but yeah, those are the things that are the most controversial things a preacher can do in a location, and it's Timothy and Titus's first job. You're going to need to wrangle these folks, get them coordinated, get them organized, get a process in place. Here are the qualifications. Figure it out and get it done. Make sure they're elders. It was a big job. And so these letters, among other things, what do we do with widows? Now here's Timothy's told, don't let anybody despise your youth. Most of his job was dealing with older people. It talks about elders, it talks about widows, it talks about, I mean, it's dealing with people that were older than him and demanded more respect than he did, but his job was to get it all in order and make it work. And so these epistles were kind of instructions for that. 2 Timothy, written a little later, 58 AD, very near to the end of the life of Paul, depending on where you date it, it's more personal and affectionate discussion of preaching. It's the book that preachers like to read. Preachers don't enjoy reading 1 Timothy because it tells us all the stuff we have to do. 2 Timothy is the romantic one about here's what is wonderful about our job, and here's where we fight evil and preach the gospel, and you know, wonderful things happen. And then at the end of your days, you can say, I finished my course, I've kept the faith, and that's the way it's supposed to go. 1 Timothy is how it actually goes. 2 Timothy is how every preacher wishes it went. It's more personal and more affectionate. You might think of it as a passing of the torch to a next generation. Chapter 4 has that famous charge. I charge you before Jesus Christ. Preach the word, be instant, in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine, and on and on and on, right? So it's gets you excited, blood-boiling stuff if you're a preacher. And it's very affectionate in that way. Peter's epistles, sometimes called the Petrine, awkward word for me, but Petrine epistles, and then Jude, they're really hard to place. They're some of the hardest in the New Testament to place. The date I'm giving you is between 60 and 65, and I can't remember now why I ended up on those dates. Apparently I was reading something that convinced me of it when I made these notes. Both were written by Peter to a church facing severe persecution. That is 1 and 2 Peter. Jude, now if you have some time tonight and you want to investigate something interesting, read 2 Peter, just 3 chapters, and then read Jude. They sound a lot alike in certain places. And that's been a mystery for a long time. Are they supposed to sound that much alike? Now, when Colossians and Ephesians sound a lot alike, you say, well, of course, Paul wrote both of them. But here you have two books that apparently not written by the same person, but have a lot of strong parallels and are kind of cryptic in places. It's been suggested maybe they draw on the Apocrypha, or maybe they draw on Jewish tradition that we don't have anymore. They refer to things as if it was common knowledge. What's that bit in Jude where they're, you know, when Michael and the devil had that argument, you remember that, don't you? When Michael and the devil had an argument? No, I don't remember that. Where does that happen? But Jude talks about it like, you know, everybody knows. You know, when Michael, the archangel, and the devil had that argument. And so it kind of refers to things that you're supposed to know. And what is that about? So they're really kind of tough to study and to place. Where in church history in those early years did someone need to write this? When did the Spirit say they need to know this? That's really hard to do. So a lot of critics have a hard time with these books, trying to figure them out. And I'll admit I struggle with them a little bit too. They seem to be, in my mind, 2 Peter especially, towards the end of the life of Peter, and it's a strong rebuke of fakes and frauds. That toward the end of the life of Peter, the apostles were getting older, many of them already dead, and the church is having to discern, who do we listen to now? And 2 Peter even hints at the idea that at some point I'm throwing off this tabernacle, and you're going to have to figure this out. Chapter 2 of 2 Peter, and nearly the entire book of Jude, is just dedicated to describing what a false teacher would look like so that you would know how to recognize it. Does that sound like a warning of a man in his late years saying, you've got to figure this out? And that's what it sounds like to me. 2 Peter, chapter 2, is the only place in the New Testament where the phrase false teacher is ever used. Everywhere else in the New Testament, you read about false prophets and other sorts of awful people. But one occasion in the New Testament does it say there is such a thing as a false teacher. And it even says it like this. In times past, there were false prophets, even as there are now false teachers. So it's to me, it's a development of a new kind of problem in the church. And Peter is saying, I'm not going to be here. You've got to figure out how to deal with this. Here's what it looks like. And that's the way I take those epistles. Don't preach on them a lot because they're confusing. And then finally, the book of Revelation. I change my mind on Revelation just about every other week, Randy. It just depends on how recently Randy's talked to me. He tries to change my mind, and then I do, and then I don't. I go back and forth. You too. That's the problem. One of us needs to make up our mind, Randy, and then stop. But it depends on when the last time I read Wallace's book is, about how strongly I feel about it. It's pretty convincing. Anyway. There's one school of thought that would put it focused on Roman persecution in the time of Domitian, around the 80s and 90s AD, towards the close of the century. This would be John, the last of the apostles, writing the last of the letters. And presumably, you would put 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John at the same time, or ballpark. And then there's another school of thought that has it earlier, that says, no, this deals more with events relating to the fall of Jerusalem. If that's the case, then you'd put it closer to 67 to 70 AD, when Jerusalem ultimately falls. So it kind of depends on which view you take and where you want to put it historically. Much as I joke about it with Randy, I don't lose a lot of sleep over it. And I think the ultimate vision of Revelation is actually clear. The details, usually not very clear to me, but the ultimate vision is clear, and it is the triumph of Christ over the devastating persecution of that era. And it ends with a vision of God's people coming down out of heaven, adorned, beautifully adorned as a bride for her husband. Well, that's not how they saw themselves. They saw themselves beat up, battered, covered in blood, persecuted to the point of death and extinction. And John says, well, that's not what God showed me. God showed me this beautiful bride. That's good news. Because that's a different story than they would have thought was playing out. And so it's, strange as it may sound, Revelation is a very encouraging book as long as you're not persecuting the church. If you're persecuting the church, it's not a very encouraging book because it spells out your doom in bloody and uncertain terms. No uncertain terms. I forget which commentator famously said that the book of Revelation is simple. God wins, pick a side, don't be stupid, is the simple message of Revelation. God wins, pick a side, don't be stupid. And sometimes it really is just that simple. Just to repeat, Revelation discusses the persecution of the church, uses prophetic metaphorical images of the judgment of God and the church's victory. 1 John is like reading the Gospel of John without the stories. It's kind of the doctrine that comes out of John's Gospel, and it talks about the significance of that for Christian living. And then 2nd and 3rd John are very short personal epistles written to either early churches or individual people. There's always some debate about who's the elect lady? One of the epistles is written to the elect lady. Was there a lady that was really great and he wrote her a letter? Or is the elect lady how John described the church and he was writing to the church generally? And again, pick a commentary and they'll tell you why it has to be this one or that one. But regardless, they're pretty affectionate short epistles that were just statements of encouragement as things were going bad. At that period in history, they had gotten far enough along. You would think if you were being persecuted, you wouldn't have time to fight over anything else. But we know better. And there were some doctrinal divisions already at work in the early church. Some of them over the very identity of Jesus himself. Was Jesus, in fact, God? Was Jesus, in fact, flesh? Could he be both? And so some people were walking out of church doors. So think about this a minute. You're a struggling group of Christians being persecuted. And you have a doctrinal debate, and about half of them get up and leave. How disheartened are you? Not only are they killing you, you can't even keep your own group together. Completely demoralizing. So these epistles deal with why do we stay the course? It spends a little time on those other guys have made their choice, and we can't do anything about that. We've got to stay the course. Don't involve yourselves in their mistakes, their failures. 2 John spends some time on that. Don't even, King James says, don't even bid them Godspeed, right? Don't invite them in for dinner. Just let them go their way. You focus on what you're doing and stay the course. And that seems to be kind of how those epistles wrap up. So some conclusions about the writing of the New Testament. The writing of the New Testament comes from a variety of authors, contexts, and episodes that fit within the middle of the first century. And that's the important point of tonight's lesson. I don't expect you to go home and remember everything I said about all these epistles, or even that I got it all right. The important part, I think, is that every epistle or letter in the New Testament was written to a group of people, that's first of all not you, that was going through some episode in the early church's history. It was a response to someone. Something had happened, and a letter was needed, or a sermon was needed, and this is what God sent. So it's important to remember that when you're reading it. and I say this very cautiously, I don't want you to misunderstand me, not a single word of the New Testament was written to you. Every word of the New Testament was written for you. But it was written to somebody else. And so first you ask, what did it mean? What was going on in Corinth? What did it mean for Paul to say this, not to me, to them? And then once you kind of figure that out, you say, now what do I get from that? Why does God need me to know what Paul told them? Because he does, right? God wants you to have it and learn it and study it and live it. But first you say, what was the point of it? Don't transport it 2,000 years like it arrived in your mailbox, because it didn't. It arrived in their mailbox. It was read in their churches. Now, why did God need you to hear a letter written to a church 2,000 years ago? And then that's the question that you start learning from. Oh, it turns out we're a lot like those churches. Turns out we need the same solutions that those churches needed. Turns out, see, and that starts to change the way you think about things. The books comprise a snapshot of the early church wrestling with difficult issues. So if you have a question today, is every question the church will ever face discussed in Scripture? Not hardly. But you can find how the church faced difficult questions. And then when you come up with this new question, usually they're not new, but some new question that you don't know what to do with, you say, now I know how they answered those questions. Let's see if we can do that. And you approach it the same way they did, like they were for the first time. And it stands alone as the definitive picture of the identity and function of the church. No matter what anybody else says, and I'm a big fan of church history, I love to study church history, but ultimately, the one indisputable picture of what the church is supposed to be is the New Testament picture. Everything else is someone trying to do that, for better or worse, oftentimes worse. And so our job is to look and definitely learn from the people who have gone before us, good things they've done and bad things they've done. But remember that the picture in the New Testament is the picture that we're trying to imitate, not what the church looked like 500 years ago or 50 years ago or 5 years ago, but the New Testament. Okay, thanks for your attention.